Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Hot enough for you? It's been a humid mess of a day here in New York, but I have just the thing to cool you off. Don't worry, I'm not going to go for some lame Christmas in June thing here, but this song does have something to do with our live music guest. See, the Little Drummer Boy has a kind of complicated history in terms of where it came from, but one of the composers credited as a co-writer of the song was Harry Simeon, who had the first big hit recording of the song with his Harry Simeon Chorale in 1958. Well, Simeon's granddaughter is the singer, guitarist, and songwriter Laura Stevenson, and she and her band will play some songs, songs that are about as far from Christmas as you can get, here in the Soundcheck studio. We'll also meet the members of the Latin pop band La Santa Cecilia. They have a song called Ice, El Hielo. And despite the title, this ice also has nothing to do with winter. It stands for Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and the song has become a kind of anthem of the immigration reform movement. But first, here's an anthem for a very different movement.
'Cause ladies love outlaws like babies. Love stray dogs.
Ladies touch babies like a banker touches gold.
Outlaws touch ladies somewhere deep down in their soul.
Okay, so maybe it's not an anthem, though that line about outlaws touching ladies probably turned a few heads in 1972. That's when Waylon Jennings recorded this song, Ladies Love Outlaws, a good example of what's come to be known as outlaw country. Along with Willie Nelson, Kris Kristofferson, and a handful of others, these country music outsiders ended up becoming legends of American music. Their intertwined stories are the topic of a new book by the writer and documentary producer Michael Streisguth. The book is called Outlaw, Waylon, Willie, Kris, and the Renegades of Nashville. Michael Streisguth, good to have you back on Soundcheck.
John, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Let's define our terms first, shall we? Outlaw country. It's been around for decades. What does it mean?
The outlaws were people who made music according to their own vision. They broke with the formula in Nashville. They decided that they wanted to sing their own songs.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to use the studio musicians that they chose, not the musicians that the producer chose. They wanted to choose their own producers.
Well, and very early on in your book, you make the point that not having Chet Atkins produce your record was like a big deal in Nashville at a certain point in the 60s.
These staff producers were loath to let go of their control over these recordings, and for a number of reasons. I mean, part of it was budgets. That's just the way the studio system, like in Hollywood, was set up. You had these contract artists, you gave them a script, you put them in the studio, and they did their thing. And people didn't really start talking about artistic freedom until the late 60s and the early 70s. The times were changing. Now, the exception to that in Nashville was always Johnny Cash. He's somebody who always did things his way. And I think the guys like Waylon and Willie noticed that and yearned for that.
And Waylon Jennings, it didn't take him long to kind of, you know, sort of mark his territory with songs like this one. This is somewhat later, though, 1975, but kind of gets to the point. The title is, Are You Sure Hank Done It This Way? Referring, of course, to the great Hank Williams.
Lord, it's the same old tune, fiddle and guitar. Where do we take it from here? Rhinestone suits and new shiny cars. It's been the same way for years. We need to change. Somebody told me when I came to Nashville, son, you finally got it made. Old Hank made it here. We're all sure that you will, but I don't think Hank done it this way. No, I don't think Hank done it this way. Look at.
Well, that's almost everything about that song is a shot across the bow of the country music establishment in Nashville, Mike. It's Waylon Jennings, and you know, the idea that it's always been done this way in Nashville, and him saying, I don't think Hank Williams did it this way.
That's right. He was saying it's time to change. Things have to change. And at the same time, though, and this is what I love about Waylon, this was recorded in 1975. At this point, the outlaw marketing label had really sprung up, and it was out there. And he was questioning that even. He was saying even in his own career, he had had quote unquote artistic freedom for 3 or 4 years. He had negotiated a contract that let him do what he wanted in the studio. But even at that point, he's questioning himself. Are you sure Hank done it that way? Mm-hmm. Funny story about that song. The idea for the song came from Ernest Tubb. The Ernest Tubb band would get on the bus after a sweaty night, the clothes sticking to their skin, and they'd ask each other, are you sure Hank done it this way?
Where did the term outlaw country even come from?
Well, there's some debate about that. You had a woman named Hazel Smith who was working for Tom Paul Glaser, who owned the Glaser Brothers Sound Studio in Nashville, where Waylon recorded, Willie recorded, others recorded there as well. A lot of freedom in that studio. And Hazel also booked these acts. She was involved in that. And a radio station asked her once, well, what do you call these guys? And she said she grabbed the dictionary and she found the word outlaw, and that's where it came from. But at the same time, there were journalists, primarily a writer named Dave Hickey, who wrote for Country Music Magazine at the time, a Texas native, who actually dated Marshall Chapman, who was a female singer on the Nashville scene. And he wrote an article called In Defense of the Telecaster Outlaws. And so you see the term blossoming there, 1974, 75.
And with the reference to the Telecaster, the electric guitar, much loved by rock guitarists, you see the beginnings or the evidence of that crossover, that hippies, rock fans, were coming to the music of people like Kris Kristofferson. As you point out, much of that through Johnny Cash taking a young Kris Kristofferson under his wing. Meanwhile, Willie Nelson and Waylon Jennings are signed to RCA, which doesn't seem to know what they've got, what to do with them, how to market them, at least at first.
That's true. One thing I do want to say about RCA in the 1960s, it was the corporation, it was the man that had to come down in order for this outlaw thing to proceed. But with reference to Willie Nelson, I do have to give RCA credit. I've gone back and listened to a lot of that music. RCA was trying to find the right sound. They were trying to work creatively with this wonderful lyricist who Willie was. But you're right, the times were changing. There was the liberation of the times that seeped into Nashville. And people don't always give Nashville credit for having this underground artistic scene. That found a home in the West End of Nashville, which was like a glint of San Francisco in the Bible Belt. Lots of experimentation. And Waylon saw this. Willie saw it. Kristofferson had come to Nashville in 1965 to be a songwriter. He was trying to conform to the formula. He was trying to temper his rambling ballad style. But then he found sponsorship in the producer, Fred Foster, who was an independent record label owner. also owned the music publishing Combine Music, who had basically given Roy Orbison his birth, Dolly Parton. He had recorded Willie Nelson in the early 60s. Fred Foster lets Chris be Chris. So that freedom is very important. The times are very important. The neighborhood, the West End in Nashville, is very important.
And Kris Kristofferson is, even among the outlaws, a kind of a singular figure because he keeps going away. You know, Hollywood keeps calling and Nashville keeps pulling him. I mean, he's really kind of this push-pull between these two very different creative poles.
You know, Chris was, after he became well-known, after he became Nashville's very own Bob Dylan, he didn't stay in town very long. A few bright, shining years, 1969, 70, 71, Johnny Cash begins recording his music, Ray Price, Waylon Jennings, even Willie Nelson. So Kristofferson's star explodes very quickly, and the next thing you know, Hollywood finds him, as you say. And then there are artists and there are music publishers who are saying, Chris, come on back to Nashville. The best songs you wrote were when you lived here in Nashville. And Chris said, this is in the mid-70s, look, I'm doing a movie in a hot tub with Barbara Streisand. You want me to give this up? And Kristofferson never felt like his songwriting suffered. And I think that there is a perception that it suffered and certainly was not as commercially viable as it had been. But there's still some very good songs that Chris is writing in the mid-70s, the late-70s, that I think bear some reexamination.
Well, we've certainly heard some of Kris Kristofferson's songs for many, many years, many people without even realizing they're Kris Kristofferson songs. And perhaps the best example is Me and Bobby McGee, which he wrote and recorded in 1969. Of course, Janis Joplin would later top the charts with it in 1971. But this is Kris Kristofferson's version of Me and Bobby McGee.
Took us all away to New Orleans. I took my harpoon out of my dirty red bandana and was blowing sad while Bobby sang the blues. With them windshield wipers slapping time and Bobby clapping hands, we finally sang a velvet song that driver knew. Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing ain't worth nothing, but it's free. Feeling good was easy, Lord, when Bobby sang the blues. Feeling good was good enough for me. Good enough for me and Bobby McGee.
Kris Kristofferson, Me and Bobby McGee, a song he wrote in 1969, and then he recorded it, and then, of course, Janis Joplin recorded it, had a huge hit, and then they reissued Kris Kristofferson's version to kind of ride on the coattails of Janis Joplin. Michael Streisguth is with me here in the studio, the writer and documentary producer. His new book is called Outlaw, Waylon, Willie, Chris, and the Renegades of Nashville. And how closely allied were these three by nature and by dint of Nashville sort of lumping them together?
Well, we can't forget that they're all Texans by birth. So they have that Texas thing going on. It was really Waylon and Willie who had a closer relationship. As the outlaw movement, which was largely a marketing effort, gained steam, you began seeing particularly Waylon and Willie showing up together on record. It happened all the time. But also the three of them showing up on concert bills as well. So it became very common for them to show up, even while Chris was in Hollywood. I mean, he always loved having that experience of performing with Waylon and Willie. And, of course, this all culminates in the 1980s with the Highwaymen. They bring Johnny Cash in, and so the next thing you know, it's a supergroup.
Right.
So there was certainly a bond there. I do think that for marketing purposes, it was hyped. But nonetheless.
And was it just the three of them? Was it just Whale and Willie and Chris? I mean, weren't there any Jennies or Alices or Annies in this movement?
Well, it was very much a male movement. There's no question about that. And we might throw in David Allan Coe. And, you know, what I tried to do in the book was really expand and loosen the definition of outlaw, because there are many people who are flooding into Nashville in the late 60s and early 70s who are recording music the way it sounds in their heads, who are writing the kinds of songs that perhaps are based on a Dylan template rather than a Harlan Howard template. So you have people like Guy Clark and Rodney Crowell, Diane Davidson, Billy Joe Shaver, who are part of this scene. And they are very important because they begin supplying material to these top dog outlaws that we're talking about. So there's a link there. And once again, this gets back to the idea that there was really something artistically exciting happening in Nashville, this corporate country music town that we don't always associate with freedom.
Right. You mentioned Rodney Crowell, and of course, the latest album by Rodney Crowell and Emmylou Harris, they do an old Kris Kristofferson song on that record. So, you know, kind of coming full circle. At some point, this marketing hype reaches a kind of fever pitch, it seems, in the mid-70s, when country music gets its first million-selling record. And what is that record?
It's called Wanted the Outlaws. And by this time, Willie Nelson had gone to Columbia Records, and he'd recorded the huge album, Redheaded Stranger. And RCA was fishing around for a way to bring Waylon up to the same level commercially in record sales that Willie was at. And Jerry Bradley, who's the head of A&R in Nashville at RCA at the time, decides to take some old Willie songs, some old Waylon songs. He grabs Tom Paul Glazer and one of his old songs, and Jesse Coulter, who was Waylon's wife, one of her songs, and he puts it all together in an album. The big single from the album is Good Hearted Woman, a song that Waylon and Willie had done earlier. He dubs in what sounds like some canned applause to give it a kind of a loose, live feel. And as you say, the next thing you know, Nashville has its first million seller.
So was this a live recording, this Good Hearted Woman? Because it's supposed to sound like it.
It's supposed to sound like it, but it's a studio recording. Done many, many times live after that by Waylon and Willie.
Wow.
But that began the franchise. I mean, that was the beginning of the Outlaw franchise, and it was the beginning of the Waylon and Willie franchise, which is just as commercially potent throughout the 1970s.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, not live, from the album called Wanted the Outlaws.
A long time forgotten, dreams that just fell by the way. The good life he promised ain't what she's living today.
Really?
But she never complains of the bad times or the bad things he's done, Lord.
Yeah.
She just talks about the good times they've had and all the good times to come.
She's a good-hearted woman in love with a good-time man. She loves him in spite of his ways she don't understand. Through teardrops and laughter they pass through this world hand in hand. A good-hearted
Good-hearted Woman from the hit record Wanted the Outlaws, 1976, featuring Willie Nelson and Waylon Jennings. And as Michael Streisguth, the author of Outlaw, has just been telling us, that was not recorded live, but rather kind of, I mean, it's almost hysterical to listen to, knowing what was happening with the cheering comes in and then just suddenly, like, it's gone. you know. Reminds me of the story of Johnny Cash at Folsom Prison.
one of the greatest shocks I've ever had as a music writer was sitting in the Sony studios a few years ago listening to the raw tape of Folsom Prison Blues from the Folsom concert and hearing Cash sing, "I Shot a Man in Reno Just to Watch Him Die," and then hearing silence.
Right.
I asked the engineer, "Can you go back and do that again?" Silence. I said, "Well, we need to listen to the edited tapes." And sure enough, as you watch the edited tapes roll by, you see a Cash's
splice.
Lyric, and you see that those two pieces of tape. I nearly fainted.
Yeah, they spliced in the famous cheering of the convicts, which, of course, as you explained in that book, would never have been allowed. You know, so crazy, crazy stuff. Anyway, the new book is called Outlaw, Waylon Willie Chris and the Renegades of Nashville. There's an awful lot of drug use going on in this book. I mean, how much was that part of the whole outlaw image?
You know, cocaine almost becomes its own character in this book. Rodney Crowe talks about there being a lot of pot use in the early 70s, and it was kind of a gentle thing. But then cocaine really came roaring in the mid-70s and really just kind of messed with the way people were thinking. And Waylon particularly was doing a lot of cocaine, spending a lot of money on his cocaine. And that reaches a head in 1977 when he's in a studio in Nashville recording, and federal agents burst in and arrest him. And you know, some people would call that kind of the end of the outlaw. We see in some of Waylon's music after that period a tempering of the kind of bad guy outlaw image. We hear some more sentimental music in his albums. There's a great song written by Tony Joe White called Billy, which people don't really know too much about, but it talks about two range riders who have to part ways, and it's very, very, very symbolic, I think.
Mm-hmm. What about, I mean, to go back to a song with a much more kind of clear and obvious title, Waylon Jennings' 1978 song, "Don't You Think This Outlaw Bit's Done Gone Out of Hand?" Is that him just basically saying, "Yeah, that was then, this is now, let's leave it"?
Well, it was a lot like, it's a sister song, I think, to "Are You Sure Hank Done It This Way." Again, he's questioning it. He's questioning the outlaw thing and the marketing circus that had begun. He says, you know, "Someone called us outlaw in some old magazine." Waylon had a love-hate relationship with the press. He was suspicious of the press. He didn't like how the press portrayed him. And this song is an angry response to that. But sure enough, I think if we think about another song, that's certainly one that's kind of tolling the end of the outlaw thing.
1978, Waylon Jennings recorded, "Don't You Think This Outlaw Bit's Done Gone Out of Hand."
I'm for law and order the way that it should be. The song's about the night they spent protecting you from me. Someone called us outlaws in some old magazine. New York sent a posse down like I ain't never seen. Don't y'all think this outlaw bit just done got out of hand? What started out to be a joke that all don't understand? Was it singing through my nose that got me busted by the man?
That is Waylon Jennings. "Don't You Think This Outlaw Bit's Done Gone Out of Hand." Michael Streisguth, the author of Outlaw, Waylon Willie, Chris, and the Renegades of Nashville. I just find it ironic that, you know, that song uses the musical language that made him an outlaw country star to begin with to question the whole outlaw thing.
You know, the funny thing is that I think Waylon was beginning to feel trapped by the formula and the outlaw formula. And it's funny, or you could call it the Waylon and Willie formula. The A&R man, Jerry Bradley, would call this outlaw bit song one of Waylon's inside-the-business drug songs. And he hated when Waylon referred to himself or his experiences in his songs. And he says, he would say, why don't you just go do something with Willie again? and of course, Willie was getting it on the other side. Willie was getting it at Columbia. Look, can you just go do something with Waylon? Because these records are selling millions. And this is in 1977, 78. Willie says, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to go record an album of standards.
Right.
And everybody thinks that's crazy. Everybody in the industry, but we know what happens. It stayed on the charts for 5 years or something like that.
So. And people forget, all these aging rockers going back to the Great American Songbook. Willie Nelson got there first. I mean, that was really, I remember head spinning, Exorcist style, when Willie Nelson released that record. So Kristofferson went to Hollywood. Willie, you know, continues to be Willie. Waylon Jennings sort of flames out, comes back, has passed away now. What have they left behind? Is there an outlaw country movement still?
They definitely established an outlaw archetype. And, of course, the outlaw had always been present in country music. I mean, the Jimmy Rogers character, the guy who was, you know, riding the rails. Mm-hmm. Hank Williams, the guy whose problems with the Grand Ole Opry were very public. Johnny Cash
and his
drug
sure.
arrests.
Yeah.
I mean, so living outside the written law has always been part and parcel of some people in country music. But I think these men put their own spin on it. It's very much a kind of a cowboy western thing, kind of a bit of a dark side. So we still see that archetype alive today in people like Zac Brown and Jamie Johnson, for example.
So that is a movement that endures today, but which really begins with three country music icons who hardly need their last names mentioned: Waylon, Willie, and Chris, the topics of Michael Streisguth's new book called Outlaw, Waylon, Willie, Chris, and the Renegades of Nashville. Mike, it's been a pleasure having you back on Soundcheck. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John. It's been great.
My strings are kind of rusty, and I'm a little dusty, but you'd be too if you'd been where I've been.
A little bit of the Guitar Song by Jamie Johnson. Up next, members of the Latin pop band La Santa Cecilia talk about their protest song El Hielo, about the lives of undocumented immigrants. And later, singer-songwriter Laura Stevenson and her band play live. This is Soundcheck.
Hey, come on by and listen to my song.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. This is a song by La Santa Cecilia, a Latin pop band based in Los Angeles. Their new album called 30 Días, or 30 Days, is all over the genre map. There's cumbia, reggae, soul, tango, and much more. But on this track, La Santa Cecilia enters the world of the protest song. It's called El Hielo, which in Spanish means ice. And for many undocumented workers living in the United States, ICE means Immigration and Customs Enforcement. El Hielo tells the story of three immigrants living in fear of the law enforcement agency. And for the band La Santa Cecilia, it hits close to home. La Marisol is the stage name of Marisol Hernandez. She's the band's lead singer. Jose Pepe Carlos plays the accordion and the requinto, a type of guitar. They spoke with Soundcheck producer Katie Bishop last week.
So there's been a lot of talk about your song El Hielo, which means ice, for those of us who took a few years of Spanish. But yes. Can you explain to listeners what that song actually is saying? A lot of people might not really be able to understand.
Well, we wrote this song called El Hielo, also known as ICE, which, also is, Immigration's Custom Enforcement. And we wanted to write this song about immigration, talking about deportations because it's something that it's a subject that we know about, that we've lived. You know, we come from immigrant parents. Some of us were born in this country. Some of us were brought here when we were very young. And we felt the need to talk about this.
And Pepe, can you explain what some of the lyrics in the song are actually saying? Some of the first lyrics in the song?
Well, the song talks about three people. Eva, which is Marisol's mom, and she's a domestic worker. And we also have Jose, who's a gardener, drives around the city, but he doesn't have a license, but he makes every garden look like Disneyland. And we have Marta, who's a dreamer, and she goes to school, and even though she doesn't have the scholarships or the financial help, she's still fighting hard so she could have her master's degree.
Let's actually hear a little bit of the song. This is from La Santa Cecilia, and this is the song El Hielo.
Eva pasando el trapo sobre la mesa y está cuidando que todo brille como una perla. Cuando llegue la patrona que no se vuelva a quejar, no sea cosa que la acuse de ilegal. José atiende los jardines, parecen de Disneyland. Maneja una troca vieja sin la licencia. No importa si fue taxista allá en su tierra natal. Eso no cuenta para el tío Sam. Anda suelto por esas calles. Nunca se sabe cuándo nos va a tocar.
I'm Katie Bishop, soundcheck producer. We're talking today with La Marisol and Pepe Carlos, two members of the Los Angeles-based Latin pop band La Santa Cecilia. Their new song is about undocumented immigrants, and it's called Ice El Hielo. So I heard a couple of the things that you mentioned, Disneyland and your mother.
Eva, yes.
Eva, yeah. How personal is this song to you?
Well, this is a very personal song for us because we're using real people that we know that inspire us and using positive stories of hardworking people, hardworking immigrants, and also telling the story of how ICE is on the loose on the streets, and you never know when it'll be your turn. I think it was also like an exhaust valve, because we've lived it in this band, where we want to travel, we want to go out of the country and make our band grow and share our music with other people, but because not all of us have the proper documentation, it's a little hard.
And Pepe, this actually, you know, talking about going on tour, this is actually something that you've struggled with. I know that you came here as a young child.
Yeah, I was brought here at the age of 6 years old, and it's been 24 years since. And like Marisol said, I am undocumented. I have no papers, and it's been hard because the band gets to travel, and now we're getting offers to go other places, and it's been... I haven't been able to fulfill that dream as well, you know, to travel with them. So it's not easy, but I think with this song, we want to put our grain of salt to the movement of demanding an immigration reform for people like us, for people like me in my situation, for people that come here to this country and contribute to the economy, contribute to the culture of this country, to the growth. And so now we're definitely demanding an immigration reform.
Was it scary for you to put out this song?
Well, we put out the song with the intention of telling 11 million people's story. It's not easy to share your feelings and you know, you live in fear because every day or just by traveling through the border states, it's not easy at all when you know that at any time you could get stopped by a border patrol and being asked for your identification. I don't have one, it hasn't been as easy as people might think it is, you know, just to travel. But But we still continue. We still continue, and we can't let anything bring us down from our dreams or stop us from our dreams. And it's the song is there to contribute to this movement, and hopefully we can make change happen.
I'm soundcheck producer Katie Bishop. I'm talking with two members of La Santa Cecilia, the singer La Marisol, and the accordion and guitar player Pepe Carlos. The band's new song, Ice, El Hielo, tells the story of three undocumented immigrants. Are there other artists who have inspired you or other songs that you've looked to for inspiration?
I remember this song from Los Lobos, you know, that you know, they say, sing about being Mexican-American and being proud and how circumstances in life brought them to this country.
Por mi madre yo soy mexicano, por destino soy americano. Yo soy de la raza de oro, yo soy mexico-americano. Yo te comprendo el inglés, también te hablo el castellano. Yo soy de
And also, I mean, songs like Bob Dylan, man, you know? Like, how many roads does a man walk down before you can call him a man?
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many seas must the white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? Isn't how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
And songs like that inspire us, because with songs like these, we remind people that it's possible to change, to make change. And with our song, we try to inspire people and to tell this story, you know, about immigration and humanize this subject.
Pepe, what about you? Any particular artists or songs that have inspired you?
Yeah, there's one that I always remember and brings tears to my eyes. It's a traditional song from Los Tigres del Norte. They've always been at the forefront also of immigration. And it's called Jaula de Oro. You're in this cage.
A golden cage.
A golden cage, right? And you've been here for so many years, and you're still afraid of going out on the streets because you never know if they're going to deport you. Your kids call this place home, and they don't even speak Spanish anymore, but you're still in that situation where at any moment, this is not your land, according to the laws.
Aquí estoy establecido en los Estados Unidos. 10 años pasaron ya en que crucé de mojado y papeles no he arreglado. Sigo siendo un ilegal.
That's a little bit of the song Aula del Oro by Los Tigres del Norte. La Marisol and Pepe Carlos, thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
La Santa Cecilia's latest album is called 30 Días. I'm producer Katie Bishop. This is Soundcheck.
Coming up next, an in-studio performance from Laura Stevenson and her band. And visit us online tomorrow night at 7 p.m. to watch the live video webcast of our sold-out soundcheck performance in the Green Space. We'll have live music from Robert Randolph and the Family Band, and conversations with comedian Tig Notaro and composer Jeff Richmond of 30 Rock and Saturday Night Live. The event is sold out, but you can watch it online tomorrow night at 7 Eastern Time on soundcheck.org. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Long Island native Laura Stevenson was born into music. Her grandfather co-wrote The Little Drummer Boy, and her grandmother sang with Benny Goodman's orchestra. But Laura Stevenson's own music draws on some more recent influences. It's emotional folk pop with a rock and roll spirit. Her new album is called Wheel, and we'll hear more about it in a moment. But first, let's hear a song. From Laura Stevenson and her band, live on Soundcheck, this is Runner. That is Laura Stevenson and her band live on Soundcheck with a song called Runner. Let me introduce you to the members of the band. Laura Stevenson, of course, singing and playing guitar. Alex Billig playing accordion and piano. Dave Garwacki behind our drum kit. Mike Campbell playing the bass. Peter Nadeo also playing electric guitar. Laura Stevenson. Laura, lots of... You look like one of the Ramones in that song. Lots of downstrokes on the guitar there.
Yeah, I don't play with a pick, so I have to compensate.
Yeah. Well, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you.
Runner, if you just kind of are, you know, sitting at home listening to it, you might think, oh, there's a nice summery song. It mentions summer. It's sort of loping along at a really good clip, but it's kind of a dark song.
It's pretty dark, yeah.
Are you not a fan of summer?
Not me personally. I don't know. I'm from Long Island, so, you know, a lot of beach club.
Of course.
Culture.
I mean, summer is like, you know, when Long Island comes alive.
It's true. And so, but I spent, well, you know, I have a tend towards depression, you know, as you do. And so the summer kind of just
I think, exacerbates that, maybe not so much, but makes it more apparent to me because, you know, I can't isolate as much as I'd like to.
Because everyone expects you to be out there enjoying the beach.
Yeah.
Did you grow up near one of the beaches?
Yeah, I'm from Rockville Center, so I'm about 6 miles from the shoreline.
Yeah.
So I'm just north of the very south shore.
And I mentioned in the opening that, you know, you come from at least part of a musical family. Is that your dad's half or your mom's half?
My mom's half. My mother's father and mother. That was a weird sentence. My maternal
but
grandparents.
Correct.
Yeah.
Weird, but correct.
they met at CBS. They were both working in radio. And so they're very, very musical people. And my dad plays guitar and always had music in the house. So two worlds.
But like many Long Island families, your dad's family were seafaring folk.
Yeah. They had a Stevenson Shipping Lines. It was one of the biggest shipping lines in the Hudson. It's no longer, but yeah.
All right. So given the choice, I mean, you decided to go for the career path that would allow you to stay in your room and be depressed.
Yeah, not so much boats, really. Yeah. I get vertigo, so...
Oh.
Now I'm finding it affects me in terms of seasickness, so
got
to be careful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that on the road? I mean, you're just coming off a long tour.
Yeah, well, allergy season really really makes it act up because if I have, like, fluid in my head, then it just kind of throws everything out of whack and my inner ear goes crazy. So it only really started getting bad after we stayed at Joshua Tree Inn, which was, like, you know, it's like a really famous hotel, so... We had a day off, and then all the desert pollen just, like, attacked my head, and I woke up with really bad vertigo. So
what do
you do?
I guess you leave Joshua Tree is
what
you do. Yeah,
unfortunately.
So this album Wheel, this is your third. It's got a really kind of fleshed-out sound, which you're doing a pretty good job of recreating here in the Soundcheck studio today. But many of the songs kind of follow the runner pattern, you know, sort of bright, vibrant surface and then these layers of darker stuff underneath. Is that I mean, there are sort of traditions like that. A lot of Caribbean music, for example, you know, people think of calypso as being very happy music till you listen to the words.
Yeah.
So what is it about that tension that appeals to you?
I think it's an easier way to discuss darker topics. I don't want to kind of have it all gloom and doom. You know, it's more palatable, and I like to listen to music that makes me feel excited, even if, you know, and if the lyrics excite my brain and the music excites my soul.
Yeah.
Not to sound totally corny, but yeah, I think there's that juxtaposition in life that you have to express, you know, like the sad and the good.
Well, and then there's that old African tradition of dancing your cares away.
You could do that,
You know, so a lot of that music, very up-tempo, but also very dark or sad in terms of theme.
Focusing on your cares.
So what music do you listen to that gives you that?
What do I even listen to? I'm really bad. what was I listening to today? I was listening to the Lemonheads. I'm listening to the Lemonheads pretty much exclusively right now.
Okay.
I go through, like, weird phases. So mostly like the Lemonheads.
So you're back in the 90s.
Yeah, that's like as far as I can get. Because I grew up very, my parents, you know, were born in like 48 and 49. So they're kind of stuck in 1969 through 72. It's basically like, you know, music.
Can I just say, though, that for parents, that's not a bad time for parents to be stuck in?
No, but they got me stuck in that. So they raised me on that. And so I can't really venture too far. I can't really go to the 80s at all. I'm pretty much early 70s, like mid 60s to early 70s is like as far as I'll go. But I've been getting into the 90s. You know.
Good for you, Laura.
Thank you,
Laura Stevenson. And welcome soon to the 21st century.
I hope. Maybe. We'll see. Maybe next decade.
You did tell, I think it was E! Music, that you were a big Dolly Parton fan.
Mm-hmm.
How did that happen?
I like Dolly. I don't know. It wasn't really something that I was raised on, but her voice reminds me a lot of my grandma's voice, so I think that like, struck me. And then I started looking at the way she plays guitar, watching a lot of videos of her playing guitar, and she's insane.
Now, speaking...
She's so good.
Speaking of your grandmother... would we recognize her voice from anything?
Yeah, she did. She was on certain recordings of Benny Goodman. She did this year's Kisses. That's like the one that is most famous for like her being on it. But a lot of the recordings had like different soloists.
Right, right.
So like,
but a lot of the singers of that day were also even more famous, anonymous but famous, for like singing radio jingles and stuff like that. Your grandmother must have done some of those.
Yeah, she did Lucky Strike. She did. She was Pretty Peggy Pepper for Dr. Pepper, and that was like
Her thing. Say that again.
Pretty Peggy Pepper. She was like, I was listening to an interview.
Can I
that
just
she
say,
did.
Not only did you say that and enunciate it clearly, but
did not
pop a
did
single
I not?
P.
Oh, wow. That is rare.
Very
for
well
me.
Done. Very well done.
Thank you. I'm trying not to my popping. But yeah, she says she was an advocate for Dr. Pepper. So that was like her job was to tell people to drink Dr. Pepper, but she would always order Coca-Colas. So I don't
nice.
Know.
Nice. And Grandpa wrote Little Drummer Boy and...
Do You Hear What I
Do
Hear?
Do You Hear What I Hear? Which I actually like that song. As Christmas songs go, I kind of like that one.
Yeah, yeah. It's really good. Both of them are really good. He was just like very like atonal as like a composer kind
of.
Oh,
really? What was his name?
Harry Simeon.
Okay.
Yeah, so he was really interested in like Judeo-Roman melodies. And so,
wow.
And like really weird, like fifths and stuff. So a lot of his stuff is just like really bizarro and I think like really modern.
Yeah.
So I like to listen to a lot of his arrangements.
Nice.
Interesting.
All right, go granddad.
Yeah.
Laura Stevenson is here with her band in the Soundcheck studio. You want to just leave the boys alone for a few minutes and do something by yourself?
Sure. Yeah. You guys can go have a coffee break.
All right. The song is called The Move. This is just you with the acoustic guitar.
Yes.
All right. Let's hear it. We're speaking with Laura Stevenson. Her newest album, her third, is called Wheel, and she's performing some selections from it here in the Soundcheck studio. And this one is called The Move. Solo, unplugged, Laura Stevenson.
The ground meat, I barely slept this week, but you're lovely in the morning, all reminding me why I should be sorry. Say I love your brain, but I hate it when it pushes me away. Well, it's been down, and now you're finally finding out that I'm not supposed to get better. But I said I won't be quite like this forever, 'cause I'm a liar and a thief.
That's Laura Stevenson and a solo song called The Move, played on acoustic guitar. And, Laura, your speaking voice does not always sound like it comes out of the same person as your singing voice.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
I don't know.
Where did you learn? How have you been singing, like, since you were a little kid?
Yeah. I've been singing my whole life. I was in choirs and, you know, a cappella groups and mm-hmm. all that nerdy stuff. But, yeah, I don't know.
Now very cool nerdy stuff.
Yeah. We're still nerdy, but we're a little cooler now. I listened a lot to my grandmother sing, and so a lot of the, like, sweetness is from her, definitely.
Okay.
Southern belle. So, but my speaking voice, I sound like, you know, some jerk from Rockwell Center. So, yeah, you know.
All right. Well. Whatever works
for
you. So Wheel is the third record, and as I mentioned before, it's kind of a fuller sound than the first two. Are you happy with that? Is that sort of the direction now for the future, you think?
I think so. I don't know. You never know how you're going to feel. I might want to break it down a lot more and just, you know, focus on me and the guitar. I want to maybe, you know, make it as huge as I can. It really depends. Song to song, I mean, the songs call for totally different things. Like on Wheel, there's a lot of, like, quiet moments and then huge orchestrated moments and big rock moments. I don't know. So there's a lot of moments.
The album is called Wheel from Laura Stevenson. Laura, it's been great hearing some of those moments in the studio. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having us.
Okay.
Tomorrow on the show, the storied Hoboken, New Jersey music venue Maxwell's is closing up shop at the end of July. Yola Tango's Ira Kaplan, a veteran of the Maxwell stage, joins us to talk about memories of Maxwell's. And we'll want to hear some of yours, too. Drummer Kendrick Scott and his jazz quintet Oracle will perform songs from their latest album called Conviction. That's tomorrow on the show. See you back here at 9, and until then, check us out online at soundcheck.org and on Facebook and Twitter. I'm John Schaefer.